From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Chris Isaak joins us to play a couple of songs and talk about his new CD and his TV series on which he plays himself. His best-known songs are Wicked Game, which was recently used in a TV commercial, and Baby Did a Bad, Bad Thing, which was used in the soundtrack of Eyes Wide Shut. Also today, bluffing, cheating, and gambling, we talk with Andy Bellin, author of Poker Nation. He dropped out of grad school to play semi-pro poker. He's been a regular at several underground poker clubs in New York. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Arab leaders endorsed a Saudi peace initiative today. It calls for normal relations with Israel in exchange for the return of occupied Arab land. The decision came at the conclusion of the two-day summit in Beirut. NPR's Kate Seeley was there.
Arab leaders joined ranks to back a peace plan presented by Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah. In a landmark initiative, they offered Israel peace, security, and normal relations. In exchange, Arab states called upon Israel to withdraw from territories occupied since 1967 and to accept the establishment of a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. They called for a just solution to the Palestinian refugee problem. Delegates also endorsed a surprise agreement between Gulf War enemies Iraq and Kuwait that could end more than a decade of hostility. Following some key no-shows and public squabbles here, many thought this gathering would end in failure, but now it's being hailed as one of the most successful Arab summits in years. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Beirut.
France said today that it will continue to cooperate with the United States in the prosecution of terrorist suspect Zakariya Moussaoui, but it won't provide evidence that could result in a death sentence. The French announcement came after federal prosecutors said they'd seek the death penalty for Moussaoui, who's accused of helping to plan the September 11th attacks. Moussaoui is a French citizen of Moroccan descent, and France has abolished capital punishment. Moussaoui's lead attorney charged that Attorney General John Ashcroft was trying to influence the jury pool by announcing the decision to seek the death penalty in a televised news conference. The State Department says it has reached agreement with Russia on revamping a sanctions regime imposed on Iraq. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports from the State Department.
Assistant Secretary of State John Wolf, who runs the Bureau of Nonproliferation, wrapped up talks in Moscow, predicting the UN Security Council would pass a resolution soon revising the Oil for Food program. That's the program that allows Iraq to sell oil to buy humanitarian supplies and help ordinary Iraqis cope with a more than decades-old sanctions regime. Russia, a big trade partner with Iraq, has long called for a lifting of sanctions, but Wolf says he and his Russian counterparts reached a consensus on a list of goods that can't be exported to Iraq. In Washington, State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the goal is to lift sanctions on purely civilian goods and tighten controls on items that could help Iraq build up its weapons arsenal. He adds a new system should be in place by the end of May. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News at the State Department.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 23 points to close at 10,403 in active trading. The Nasdaq gained 18 points to close at 1845. The S&P 500 lost 3. This is NPR News. The Inspector General of the Pentagon is investigating the use of a military plane by Secretary of the Army Thomas White. White used the aircraft to fly to Colorado last month, where he completed the sale of his house in Aspen. The inspector wants to know whether the military plane was used for private business. An Army spokeswoman said White will cooperate fully with the investigation. Hollywood filmmaker Billy Wilder has died at the age of 95. NPR's Rick Carr tells us how he got his start.
He worked as a newspaper reporter in Vienna, then Berlin, where he got his first break as a screenwriter in 1929. Not long after Hitler came to power, Wilder fled to Hollywood. His English was limited at first, and it wasn't until the late 1930s that he found success as a screenwriter. Through the 40s, Wilder branched out into directing and producing. His films included Stalag 17, The Seven-Year Itch, The Lost Weekend, Witness for the Prosecution, and Irma LaDuce. In 1960, he became the only person ever to win 3 Academy Awards for a single film as co-writer, director, and producer of The Apartment. In 1981, he directed his last film, Buddy Buddy, starring two of his regulars, Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon. Wilder died Wednesday at his Los Angeles home. Rick Carr, NPR News.
A flight attendant on Virgin Atlantic Airlines has been arrested on charges of making false bomb threats during a transatlantic flight in January. Michael Philippe was arraigned on the charges in Newark, New Jersey today. Prosecutors say the 25-year-old Frenchman pretended to discover two threats, one scrawled on a lavatory mirror and another on an air sickness bag. They say that Philippe actually wrote the threats himself. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bluffing, betting, gambling, and how to spot a cheat are just some of the subjects in the new book, Poker Nation, by my guest Andy Bellin. He started to play seriously when he attended graduate school in 1992. He was studying physics and astronomy at Wesleyan University when he started to lose himself at the poker table. He got so carried away with the game that he dropped out of school shortly before he expected to flunk out. After giving up on astronomy, he played semi-pro poker for several years and got a job at the literary magazine, The Paris Review. Poker Nation is his first book. Bellin lives in New York City, where poker is technically illegal, but the law is not enforceable unless a third party is benefiting, such as in games that require a fee to play. Bellin used to belong to several underground poker clubs, but he says they broke up when Mayor Giuliani started enforcing the law. I asked Bellin what he liked about those clubs.
The one thing that I never understood about closing them was that it was safe, it was reliable, there was always a game. You knew that you weren't going to get cheated or robbed or anything like that, and they were great games. They were competitive, yet there were a lot of people there that shouldn't have been there that made it sort of profitable.
No people for you to take advantage of.
I guess so. I mean, I hate to think of it that way, but maybe I'll get back into therapy now, but yes.
Give us a sense of the range of people that would show up at these games.
There, it is the most eclectic collection of people you could ever imagine. You'd walk in at 2 in the morning on a Sunday, and it would be Park Avenue lawyer next to stripper, next to Albanian prince, next to Brooklyn cabbie. It was just the most bizarre but most entertaining group of people.
To what extent do you see poker as a game of chance, and to what extent do you see it as a game of skill?
Well, in any situation involving dice or a deck of cards, there's always an element of luck. But what you have to remember is the theory of probability, which basically defines all random activity, all random chance. And what that basically states is that the more chances you take, the more hands you play, the more times you roll the dice, the more likely it is that the odds will hold true. So in the short run, when you sit down and you play a hand or any, just for a night, there is a lot of luck involved in the game. You can get terrible cards, or you can get good cards, but which is the worst thing to do, and have somebody get better cards, and you'll lose everything. But if you look at poker as a year-long endeavor or a lifelong endeavor, then you're sort of taking the element of chance out. The theory of probability, the more hands you play, dictates that everybody will get the same cards eventually in all the same situations, and the better players will make more money and lose less money, and therefore it's a lot less chance involved.
Where did you learn how to play, and who did you learn from?
Well, I'm going to give my family a bad name. My mother taught me when I was very young, and we used to go up to my grandmother had this sort of haunted house way off in the woods of the Adirondacks, and my mother used to take my brother and I up there, and this was like, early 70s, so there was no TV, no internet, no cable, almost no telephone. So, as two city kids out in the woods, I would do terrified of everything. I would just try and keep my family up as long as possible, just doing anything. And my mother taught us how to play poker. And I think my first game was, it involved mini marshmallows as chips. And we, you know, my brother and I would just play through till the morning when we could sleep then.
So was your mother your poker mentor, or did you have a mentor more from the poker world when you got a little older?
Forgive me, Mom. No, she was not my poker mentor. But when I got into graduate school, I had a math professor who was just an absolute statistics freak. I mean, he just loved everything, would quote these bizarre deaths statistics about, child mortality in Guatemala or something. And really just that's the kind of thing that made him happy. And the one thing that he was obsessed with more than anything was poker. And one day he pulled me aside and said, "Do you play?" And I kind of chuckled and said yes. And we sort of ran off like towards the Foxwoods Casino to go play.
And so he was interested in probability and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it was, I mean, whether he would have admitted this or not, he loved the game for the same reasons that I do, the competition and the thrill, and there's sort of something sexy about it. But, I mean, the way he rationalized it to himself was that it's this perfect statistical model. You can just watch the law of averages at work anytime you sit down at a poker table. So that was actually, it's the best way to learn is to start with the math, to start figuring out what the right thing to do is and what's the wrong thing to do. And then you start learning the sort of subtleties along the way. But it was a great poker education.
If you're going to work with laws of probability when you're playing poker, you need to have a good memory and remember what cards have shown up on the table and what hands other people are likely to have, what cards are likely to show up in the future. Did you already have a good memory, or did you learn tricks to train your memory to remember what it is you need to know when you're playing the game?
I think I had an average memory, and I had operated under the assumption that memory was a birthright. You either had a great memory or you didn't. And what I found out along the way was that there are tricks, there are mnemonics, there are ways to organize things by grouping them that improve your ability to retain information. And I don't have a great memory now, but, you know, it certainly helps to try and figure out what works best for your mind, whether it's, you know, you see a series of cards laid on a table, you know, do you try and make up a story? Do you try and spell something out with their first letters? Do you group them, using patterns or something? And it's an amazing way to help your memory.
What are the things you most want to remember when you're playing?
In a game like Seven Card Stud, where there are a lot of cards exposed, it really helps to, you know, if you've got a pair of threes and you've seen one three in somebody else's hand, obviously that's going to change the way you play the game. You've just cut your odds of making three of a kind in half. So memorizing the cards that have been played is very important. But being able to, particularly because most of the poker that's played in America is played around, you know, in garages and around bar rooms and things like that, you're going to play with the same guys over and over again. So you have to keep in mind the way they play, the things they do, their tendencies. And in that way, it makes them a lot more predictable. And you can, 90% of the time, you can base your actions on more evidence. So that's really going to help you in the long run.
What kind of tendencies do you spot?
You're playing five-card draw, and somebody draws one card. The classic question is, does he have a four card straight or flush where he's drawing to a big hand, or does he have two pair and he's already got a decent starting hand? There's almost no real way to tell, except there are a lot of people that my friend John is a good example. He's a guy who, when he would have a straight or a flush draw and he needed a fifth card to make a hand, he would never bet it. He would always just call whatever was bet. He would never initiate a bet. But when he had two pair, he would always start the betting. So as soon as I figured that out, I've been playing with him for 10 years now, I when he draws one card, I know what he is doing.
This is not something you would call to his attention, right? You wouldn't say, "I've noticed that you have this habit."
I think I just did call to his attention, which is so
he
bad.
He might not be listening. But I mean, really, you obviously don't want somebody to be conscious of the things that they're doing that betray them.
Oh, of course not. I mean, these little you create your private little books on people and you keep them your whole life. I mean, I started playing with my brother when we were, I was seven. So, for 25 years almost, and I never told him that he has a great tendency to tell me what his cards are without him knowing it until I wrote the book, and I let him find out by reading the book. So,
his reaction?
He didn't believe it, and then I pointed it out actually last night at a card game. But he has, my brother's an incredibly sturdy sort of. I mean, he's got these huge hands, and he's like this very macho guy, and. He just, when he bluffs or when he does something out of the ordinary, he's absolutely steady as a rock. But when he's got the best hand and he's trapped somebody, he gets so excited that his hands shake, which is completely a dead giveaway. So for years I've known what he's had in his hands.
So do you fold when you see his hand shaking?
Immediately, without a thought, in a second. I can't get the cards out of my hands fast enough.
Do you think poker is a good game for people who are obsessive compulsive, in the sense that some people who are very obsessive compulsive get really obsessed with numbers and with counting and adding?
By good game, do you mean like a great way for them to become totally obsessed with something and lose their minds, or a good game as in
like
because they will? I mean, it's the perfect game to become completely obsessed with, but it's not healthy.
Right.
Yeah, there are so many stories of people who just had these very normal 9-to-5 lives and one day walked into a card room or a casino for the first time, and their lives were completely altered just by that introduction into this world. There's actually a great story in my book about a kid who was a JD MBA. I think he was working at a big accounting firm. Had a very normal life, wife, mortgage payments, and then somehow stumbled upon one of the card houses. And in about 7 months had lost his wife, lost his job, was $8,000 to $10,000 in debt, and is now a fugitive of the state of New York. So not so good sometimes.
Did you ever feel like you were getting anywhere close to that level of danger in your life?
I get that question all the time. I don't know how to answer that honestly. I mean, I would never have played as much as I did had I thought that I was doing something detrimental to myself. But looking back, I played a ton of poker. I mean, I was playing 5-6 nights a week, 7 hours a day. I mean, I was more passionate about this than I was about school or work or anything. I mean, I thought of it as my job, and I happened to have thought I was great at my job and loved my job. But gambling addiction is a very, very tricky addiction, more so than, I think, than alcoholism, because the warning signs are so well hidden. You know, you don't look terrible. You don't wreck cars. Your life just slowly becomes consumed by gambling. And you never give away what's happening to you until it's way too late, until you're deep, deep in debt. So I tried very hard to keep conscious of all of those things, but it's, I was never close to losing tons of money, but, looking back now, I mean, I was in, it was definitely on the brink.
My guest is Andy Bellin, author of Poker Nation. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer and poker player Andy Bellin. His new book is called Poker Nation. Now, how do you decide if someone else is bluffing? What are some of the things you look for?
Well, people do the weirdest things. You know, we all get drilled into us at an early age that lying is a bad thing to do, and all of the deception we intend to bestow upon people at a poker table it comes into conflict with that. So people have the strangest reactions. People cover their mouths when they bluff. Some people look away. Some people change the tone of their voice. Some people bet way more aggressively physically. They throw the chips in the pot when they're bluffing. Some people do it very sheepishly, like they're embarrassed to be doing this. It all depends on the person, but figuring out a tell like that is really, it's such a huge advantage. When I was in graduate school, I used to play in a game, and apparently, they didn't tell me this until after I left school. Note I said left and not graduated, but after I left school, I was notified that I had a tell where when I would be bluffing or be making a very reluctant call, if it was a $10 bet, I would be doing it with, I would make the wager with small denominations. I would use 10 $1 chips or 20 50 cent chips to get rid of my small chips. And when I was when I had a very good hand, when I was confident in it, I would use a big chip. I would throw in a $10 chip. And it's an amazing tell.
Once you realize you have a tell, is it difficult to get rid of, just as it's difficult to break nearly every habit?
I think it is, but you sort of do it proactively in the sense that you don't recognize the tell and then compensate for it. What you try and do is, whether you're bluffing or whether you're making a reluctant call or whether you've got an amazing hand, you try and go through the process of betting in the exact same way. You do it almost as mechanically as possible. Grab the chips in the same way. You throw them in the pot the same way. You look at your cards in the same way. You bet using the same inflection. And if you can do that, you're better off trying to avoid it proactively rather than reacting to it.
Have you played cards with people who you were sure, or at least pretty confident, were cheating?
I tell everybody that if you've played more than five hands of poker in your life, you've probably been cheated at one point or another, which is not to say that every game you're in is crooked, but if anybody has ever looked at, you know, the bottom card on a deck, they've cheated in a sense. They've taken advantage of some inside information and they've used it without, you know, stopping the game and saying, redeal the cards. So cheating can be in very subtle and almost meaningless ways. You know, knowing one card in a deck is an advantage, but not a huge advantage. Or you can get, you can have people try and, you know, steal the shoes off your feet. And I have been, I was in a poker game in a casino a long time ago where I found that when I didn't even realize it, I was playing with what they call a partnered team, where two people sort of signal each other what their cards are and they try and trap you in between them, where you've got a decent hand, one's got a great hand, one's got a terrible hand, and they just keep raising because they know they're going to split the proceeds in the end. So there is cheating. It's just the problem is that you have to become a very good card cheat yourself to be able to spot it. You have to learn what
like. What do you have to be a cheat to spot it?
Well, you have to be able to manipulate the deck yourself to know what it looks like when somebody else is doing it. You have to know what it sounds like when somebody is peeking at a card or dealing the second or third card off the deck and not the top one, to be able to spot it. And the only way to become familiar with it is to do it yourself.
In your book, Poker Nation, you're right, losing begets losing. Can you talk about that losing spiral that you can fall into?
Yeah, it's you find yourself in the throes of it, and you think, I can't believe I got myself into this again. But you say to yourself, I just lost money, so I have to play more poker to win. And then you play more poker to win your money back, but you've actually lost, so now you have to play even more poker. Also, the mathematics logically conspire against losing, in the sense that if you start out with $500 and you lose 50% of your money, you've got $250. Now you've got to make 100% of your money to get even. So it seems like the further you go, the more difficult it is to crawl out of the hole. And also, when you lose, you start getting frustrated. And when you get frustrated, you start playing irresponsibly. And then when you start playing irresponsibly, you start losing more. And then it becomes this vicious cycle that's terrible and wildly unprofitable and makes for a miserable evening. That's why often the best thing you can do after losing a big hand is just pick up your chips and go home and come back and fight another day.
Are you capable of doing that?
Sometimes, I think. I used to pride myself on the expression for when a player starts losing his mind at a poker table and playing irresponsibly is that he's tilting. And I used to pride myself on never tilting, but the fact was, I guess I used to tilt in my own way. Like one of the most important decisions you have to make at a poker table is if you've lost your money, do you buy back in? And the reason it's so important is you have to figure out why you've lost your money. Were you just getting bad cards and buying back in is going to further your attempts to get even because you're a favorite at that table? Or are you just completely outclassed and just go home and, you know, watch a movie and then come back and hope those guys are gone in the morning? But I was never a great judge of that. So in a sense, I would lose and then I would have that sort of tilty feeling to me, and I'd think, you know what, I got to get back in this game. I'm a favorite at this table, and a lot of the times I wasn't. So I think that was my greatest shortcoming as a player.
Do you like to play against someone who's tilting? Are they easy to win against?
Yeah, especially if you can keep them tilting. You know, you can just sort of subtly remind them of that hand that cost them $1,000 or
something.
Oh,
that's so not nice.
You know what? There's a lot about poker that's not nice. But like I said, it's warfare without weapons, you know? I mean, the psychological aspect is just as important as the card play. If you can keep a cool head where somebody else is losing they're cool, you're at a huge advantage, and that's where you make your money.
Do you believe in beginner's luck?
Absolutely. My girlfriend, the first time she played, just went on a tear. She just couldn't miss. Same is true at a horse racing track. First time I taught her how to throw dice at a crap table, she threw the dice across the table, hit a man in the head, and they fell in the well and turned out an 11, and we won. So, yes, very much so. It's a very important part of the game.
Well, Andy Bellin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. That was great fun.
Andy Bellin is the author of Poker Nation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback by H.W. Brands, The First American, The Life and Times of Benjamin Franklin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Chris Isaak plays a couple of songs and talks about his new CD and his Showtime TV series on which he plays himself and his band members play his band. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is singer, songwriter, guitarist, and actor Chris Isaac.
I'm the original American boy.
That's Chris Isaac singing the theme to his Showtime TV series, The Chris Isaac Show. The song is included on his new CD, Always Got Tonight. Isaac plays himself on his show, and the members of his band play his band. Los Angeles Times TV critic Howard Rosenberg wrote, "No comedy actors wear better than Isaac and his gifted ensemble, and no show anywhere is more charming or effortlessly amusing than this one." Isaac first became known for his 1990 record Wicked Game, which made it clear that Roy Orbison was a great influence on his singing. Isaac's recording Baby Did a Bad, Bad Thing was used on the soundtrack of the film Eyes Wide Shut. The Chris Isaac Show is now in its second season. The season began with guest star Bridget Fonda playing a rock journalist who wants to interview Chris Isaac about Roy Orbison, who she's writing a book about. To impress her, he fabricates a lot of stories about his relationship with Orbison. In this scene, Isaac walks in on his band as they're rehearsing.
So we turn that little heart.
Hey. What?
I understand you had a date last night.
I wouldn't call it a date. I had a dinner last night. A working dinner.
Looked pretty cozy to me.
Where's your head getting involved with a journalist?
Who said anything about being involved?
You lay down with intellectuals and you'll wake up with holes in your sweater. And sooner or later, she'll sell you out.
She could be writing a story secretly about you.
Chris Isaac, the tragic story of how my bad breath kept me out of the army.
I can't believe that you guys think I am so naive. Okay, we're not doing anything. I'm just telling her stories about Roy Orbison. That's all.
I hope so.
Well, how many stories about Roy Orbison do you have?
What's that supposed to mean? I got a whole bunch of them, and she's lapping them up, baby.
Well, did you know Roy was a pilot?
I did not know that.
I read it in a book.
Tell me about it. I'll use it.
Chris Isaac, welcome to Fresh Air. Whose idea was it to do a show in which you played yourself?
It was my idea.
Why'd you want to do it?
I've done a lot of acting and done movies before, and it was always in between when I was out on tour with my band.
Uh-huh.
And the one thing that I was always trying to do is, you know, I love the city life, acting and being in Hollywood and everything. That's all wonderful. But I have commitments to my band. These are guys I've been with for years, and I didn't want to have the band kind of like, you know, go ahead, guys, just sit on a lawn chair someplace. I'm going off and make a movie. And so I started thinking, what can I do that the guys would be involved in? And it was probably 3 a.m. I'm watching TV and thinking, hey, how about if they were in the show with me and we played music? Ricky Nelson did it. Ricky Ricardo did it. Maybe I can give it a shot.
Now, your mother, Dorothy Isaac, is in the series. Describe your mother's part in the series.
She plays my mother, Dorothy Isaac. She's good. And she's damn believable, let me tell you, because I know the real one, and I know the one on the TV, and they are one and the same. Well, we had people come in, and they were, you know, they kind of auditioned people to play my mom, and they had very good actresses come in. I mean, they were all talented and good, but I kept looking at them thinking, that's not my mama. And then I thought, my mom is funny and she's a natural born ham bone. So I thought I'd just ask her, because I think it's more fun in a sense. Also, when you watch the show, you kind of know, you go, that's really his mom, you know.
What was her reaction when you invited her to play herself?
She goes, I want to wear something beautiful.
And
she wanted to look good, you know. She wanted to look good on TV. And she's a good-looking lady. So everybody liked her. I have to say that. The people who work with me every day, they said, we can't believe that she's your mother. She's so sweet.
Now, your show is a great vehicle for introducing new songs. And at the beginning of the new season, you introduced your song, Let Me Down Easy, which is on your new CD. And it's great because, you sing it at a rehearsal, you sing it on stage, then you sing it at home to your new girlfriend. And by the end of the show, the audience is singing it, too. It's like you've heard it enough times that it's really, like, in your head. When you started the show, did you realize what a good vehicle it was going to be for introducing new songs?
Yeah, I mean, we're having the show be about myself and my band. We knew we were going to have a lot of music in it. And I think what was really fun for us is when we started off, we were all kind of green. We'd never done a TV show before at all. And we came to do the show, and we went the first day. We said, okay, now we're going to record. And they said, oh, no, don't worry. We're going to do playback. And we said, no. We have to have the microphones up, and we're going to really sing it and play it. And they go, well, how will you do that? How will we cut it? How can we make it fit together? We said, don't worry. It's going to fit together. It'll be like a walk through Disneyland. It's going to be beautiful. And we were kind of bluffing. We didn't know if we could do it or not, and, you know, technically. But that's what we do is, you know, you play music all the time. And when you go to a concert, you don't do 15 takes or something. You do a take, and you move on. And it worked out great. It's been fun because we don't have to lip sync. The people who come on the show, some of them are surprised, but we don't, you know, you're not doing it at a playback. People play live, and there's a lot more energy.
Okay, well, why don't we hear the song? And this is Let Me Down Easy, and this is from Chris Isaak's new CD.
I look at you, I'm just a guy. I know my place, but still I'll try. You must be tired of people asking, but I'm still asking.
That's Chris Isaak from his new CD. Everybody who knows your singing knows that you've been inspired by Roy Orbison. When did you first hear him? And I'm wondering if you used to, like, sing along with the records?
No, you know, I really liked Roy Orbison. I remember a time when I would go in and I'd ask for a Roy Orbison record and nobody knew who he was. That seems, like, strange today, but in the early 80s, before he made a comeback. But before that, people were kind of like, Roy who? People forget that he had a tough time there, and thank God he kind of got found again.
What music did your parents listen to that you were exposed to before you were buying records of your own?
Well, my parents were always kind of hipsters, you know, and they had good taste in music, thank gosh. They had my dad would listen to, like, Fats Domino, Elvis, and Lead Belly, and like cool, like rhythm and blues records. And my mom had that, and she had things like Dinah Washington. You know, I remember growing up and hearing my mom play What a Difference a Day Makes while she was cleaning the house and thinking, wow, that's a good song. And they had all the music they had. It's just weird these things stick in your head, but I remember that when I wanted to hear music, I thought my parents had all the records. I didn't know there was more. You know, you're a little kid. I thought they had all the records, and all the records were in this wooden thing at our house. And it was a cabinet. I mean, gosh, man, by today's standards, it looks like, if you had a picture of this and you go back, it looks like such poverty. It was like a little wooden cabinet and a bunch of records just piled on each other. And it was like 78s and 45s and LPs. And I'd go in there and just, you know, they let me play whatever I want, whenever I wanted. And then I would play their stuff. And then later on, because we always shopped at junk stores and secondhand stores when I was growing up, when my mom would be out shopping and looking around the store, I'd go over and I'd go through the records. And the records were like, you know, their secondhand records without a cover were like a nickel each. So I'd get stacks of records and bring them home and just go through them and play.
Who's a musician, or what's a song that you learned through that kind of chance approach to buying music that you might never have heard otherwise?
I don't know if you can hear of it. It's like,
I'll never let you go, 'cause I love you. I'm so sorry, 'cause I made you cry.
It's an old Elvis 45 I got on Sun Records, and I still remember what it looks like. And I think the name on the record, it was like some, the previous owner was Roxanne, because her name's on there.
That was a very good early Elvis
impression. I got that record, and I didn't know there was, I didn't know what Sun Records was, or uh-huh. who Sam Phillips was, or uh-huh. anything about this. This is like, you know, whatever. It was before that stuff kind of made a comeback, and I remember thinking, this is it. This is like, that was the holy grail for me. Is like when I found that Sun Sessions record, I went, this is what I want to do. And it was fun because as the years have gone along, I've actually got to play with the guys who played with Elvis, Scotty Moore, DJ Fontana, the Jordanaires, got to sing with them. And the other day I was came back from shooting the TV show in Vancouver. I go into my house and I sit down and I had a magazine. I'm looking through it. And there's an article on Sam Phillips, who was the producer for Elvis Presley's hits in the 50s. And they're talking to Sam Phillips, and I read this whole article, and I'm just gobbling it up because he's a genius. At the end of the thing, they said, well, Sam, who do you listen to today? And he said, Chris Isaak. And I mean, man, it's like that was the most exciting thing that happened to me in years. I mean, it's like tears come down my face, and I'm thinking, that's the kind of thing, like, he doesn't know that I'm going to go pick up that magazine and read it, but man, that just meant so much to me because that's the guy whose record started it for me.
When you got that first Elvis record that you heard on Sun, did you start looking for other records with that Sun logo on it?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, you don't find them. And my kind of thinking is, because I've asked other people, I've gone through a million junk stores and looked through a million records, and you very seldom find you very seldom find an Elvis record, or you find some Beatles records once in a while because there were so many. But those records are so good, people played them until they just wore out, I think. That's my theory. I mean, the records, I could tell you what you find over and over was Ferranti and Teicher. Do you remember them?
Oh, sure do.
It was like two piano guys. Now, not ragging them. I don't know why, but I would find those in every record store, and Ohio Players.
Wow, the Ohio Players. Remember, really different, yeah,
The Ohio Players, I mean, I don't know why, but I must have seen a million Ohio Players albums in secondhand stores. Maybe people bought them not knowing what kind of music because they had those sexy covers, remember?
Yeah.
Ohio Players always had like a girl on the cover who was like wrapped in a garden hose naked or something. or, you know, like it was something like that. And I think people bought those sometimes for the cover and they, later on they went, oh, here you go, I'll turn it in.
My guest is Chris Isaak. His new CD is called Always Got Tonight. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer, songwriter, guitarist, and actor Chris Isaak. He plays himself in the Showtime TV series The Chris Isaak Show, which is now in its second season. When did you get your first guitar?
My first guitar came from my girlfriend, Carol, and a real sweet girl, and she knew that I liked to sing, and so she borrowed her brother's like old beater guitar, and you had to tune it up with a pair of pliers, and it literally had to tune it with a pair of pliers because it was missing the pegs, and then it had a big decal of a daisy on the front of it, and I remember just playing that guitar to death.
So were you convinced pretty early on that this was it for you, that your life was going to be about music, or did you think, well, I love music, but I have to get like a day job, a real job?
I loved it a lot, and I really wanted to do it, and I just remember at a certain point I sat down, and I went to in Stockton. We went with my mom, and I think I was just about ready to graduate or had graduated, and I went with my mom, and she says, so what are you going to do? You know, what's your plan? And I said, you know, I had been boxing in Japan. Like the previous year, I'd been over there studying, and I had been boxing over there, and my Japanese was okay. I said, maybe I'm going to go back to Japan and teach English I can get this job. I saw this job. And I thought, you know, that's kind of using, I was an English major in college. And I thought, that's kind of using something. I'd be professional. And she said, but what about your music? And I was like, kind of like thinking, you know, I have to accept reality. I don't know anybody in show business. I don't know anything about doing this really. And I better try to get like a real job. And I said, well, I'm thinking I could do that sometimes. She goes, you're not going to be happy unless you do your music. And I just, something in the way she said it was like, you know, the voice of experience talking, that she really was like telling me, don't just throw away your chance.
So you were on the college boxing team?
Yeah. I was a light heavyweight for Aoyama Gakuin in Tokyo.
Huh.
That was the university I went to.
Did you like boxing? You weren't worried about breaking your nose or ruining your face or anything like that?
My nose broke all the time.
Really?
My nose has been broken at least six times, I think seven.
Have you had it fixed afterwards?
They straightened it because at a certain point they thought that they could make me breathe through it better if they made it straight. But they wanted to put cartilage back in it, and that means they have to take cartilage out of your ear. At least that's what they told me at the time, and I said, no, I don't want you to mess with my ear to fix my nose. I just forget it. So that's why my nose kind of curves from the side.
Let's take a pause here and listen to your first big record, Wicked Game. Can you talk about writing the song?
The Wicked Game was written very quickly. I probably wrote that song in, you know, 15, 20 minutes. Got it all finished. And it was written really late at night. Somebody called me and said, I need to talk. I want to come see you. And that was a euphemism for wanting to come over and sleep with you or, you know, climb on you. And I was in a moment of weakness. I said yes. Oh, I mean, it's a time I regretted it. But anyway, between the time she hung up and the time she came over, I wrote that song.
Well, let's hear Wicked Game. This is Chris Isaac. Chris Isaac, I've been hearing this song a lot on television. One of the commercials uses it. And is that your record, or is that like a sound-alike version of you?
That's me sounding like me.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't sure, because you know how they have people who sound like people?
Nope.
That they do?
That's me.
That's you. And why did you decide to use the song for a commercial?
So the people would hear the song.
Really?
Yeah, the more people hear it, the better, in my opinion, for me. It's like I give the song to radio, and they put it next to their advertisements for soap, but I'm still glad that people hear the song. If I give the song to a commercial, and they put it next to an advertisement next to a car, and a cool car at that, it's like, to me, that's still good. People are going to hear the song. I don't really have a problem. I know some people, they hate to have their song in any kind of commercial thing, but when I make the music, I make it exactly the way I want to. I have a lot of control over it. I'm really happy with it, and I put the record out. And past that, I'm just hoping to get it out to as many people as possible, and I want to make a living, you know? So if I can get people to put it in a commercial or something like that, that doesn't bother me.
My guest is Chris Isaac. He has a new CD called Always Got Tonight. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer, songwriter, guitarist, and actor Chris Isaak. He plays himself in the Showtime TV series The Chris Isaak Show, which is now in its second season. Often when songwriters are on the show, I ask them to redeem a song, to take a song that we might think of as being square or uninteresting, or a song that would be really out of character for you to like. And then I ask you to maybe do a few bars from that song and tell us why you like it, in spite of everybody else's preconceptions about it.
Okay, I'll give you a song. Here, I'll give you somebody I can redeem for you.
Great.
Let's see. On a day like today, we'd pass the time away, writing love letters in the sand. How you laughed when I cried each time I saw the tide take our love letters from the sand. As you made a vow that you... That's Pat Boone.
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear. It's not
love
a bad
letters
song.
Love Letters in the Sand.
Yeah.
Love Letters in the Sand is a great song.
Yeah.
And I've met Pat Boone. He couldn't be a nicer guy. And I got to tell you, he's the most vilified man and the most misunderstood man. And I often thought to myself, now why do people go, you know, we want to do rock and roll, not that Pat Boone stuff.
Well, it's because of his cover of Tutti Frutti.
But you know something? To me, is a misunderstanding by the uninformed once more. It's like Pat Boone's not famous for his cover of Tutti Frutti. I mean, you can go to hundreds of any singer, and they do hundreds of songs in their career, and you take their weak song or a song that they're not famous for and try to judge them on that, it's kind of unfair. Pat Boone is famous for Love Letters in the Sand or Sugar Moon, and if you listen to those songs, he has an amazing voice. He sings like nobody else. It's a unique style, and I always thought that he had a lot of things that were really great, and that the reason he got nailed so hard, besides his metal dressing and leather and stuff, which was kind of crazy. I don't know. What were you thinking there, Pat? I don't know. But he got nailed because he had footage of him singing Tutti Frutti. I mean, there's film footage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever they're doing a documentary, they go, well, we need footage. Oh, there's Pat Boone singing Tutti Frutti. We use that. And so he fit perfectly into the niche of somebody that they could nail.
When and how did you discover him? Because it was after he was popular.
When I'm going through old records, I would pick up Sun Records, and I would pick up Chess and Dot, and Pat Boone was on Dot. So, all the old labels, and he had a lot of nice stuff.
Another song I want to ask you about, Bad Bad Thing, which was used in the Stanley Kubrick movie Eyes Wide Shut. How did that song end up in the movie?
Nicole Kidman, God bless her long red-headed self. Nicole Kidman was using music just to rehearse the scene, I guess. And the story that was related to me is that the director, Kubrick, said, well, you know, what music do you like? And she was playing that. And he said, wow, that really works. And they called me. I was backstage at the Jay Leno show. And they said, we have some, requests to use this music. And I said, well, who's the director? Because I get a fair amount of requests for film music. I said, who's the director? And they said, Kubrick. And I said, yes. sign the deal. Talk later. To me, it was like, if the reason for doing that was the thrill of having my song in something that was done by Kubrick, who I'm such a huge fan of.
Mm-hmm.
You just go, I've been watching his films my whole life, and so I was just tickled pink that he asked to use some of mine.
Chris Isaak, his new CD is called Always Got Tonight. His Showtime TV series, The Chris Isaak Show, is now in its second season. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Chris Isaac's recording, Baby Did a Bad, Bad Thing. Thank you.
Baby did a bad, bad thing. 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 You ever loved someone so much you thought your little heart was gonna break in two? I didn't think so. You ever try with all your heart and soul to get your lover back to you? Go on, I hope so. You ever pray with all your heart and soul just to watch her walk away? Baby did a bad, bad thing. Baby did a bad, bad thing. Baby did a bad, bad thing. I feel like crying. Feel like crying. You ever toss and turn your mind awake and thinking about the one you love? Close your eyes, you're making believe you're holding the one you're dreaming of. But if you say so, it hurts so bad when you finally know just how low, 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 low she'll go. Baby did a bad, bad thing. Baby did a bad, bad thing. Baby did a bad, bad thing. And I feel like crying. I feel like crying.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Love, Greg and Lauren, a husband's day-by-day account of his wife's remarkable recovery. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we feature Jessica Williams at the piano. We often play her music on Fresh Air. She has a new CD called This Side Up. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.